Inside our hearts, someday I will. was El Sunny with How Does It Feel. Before that's Yoshito Fujigami with Virgin Island. Before that's Kilinji with Kyomo Darekano Tanjoubi. Or today is somebody's birthday. Up next, we're going to have James Felix with Open Up. Oh yeah, don't you love it when you just hear those tunes and then you close your eyes and imagine you're cruising alone the golden shores of California. You're in a Cadillac convertible and there's nothing to do for the entire afternoon but just drive. I think that's what these songs are about.
Open your eyes and you will see.
into thinking that she don't, she can fool around. Don't make her wait. And don't try to give her that worn out excuse about being tired and working late. I tell you, one day you'll come home early from work. Open up the door and get your feelings hurt, because she needs it. Yeah.
Was Ray Parker Jr. with A Woman Needs Love, and that one was from 1981. Before that, we had Richie Family with Walk With Me. I think that was one was from 1982, maybe. Well, but that's not very important, because statistically speaking, right now is the best time to play some Barry White. But no, I'm not going to play Barry White, because I don't even have that in my computer right now. Yeah, well, probably also because I don't like his hairstyle. Also, his fashion sense is, let's just say, not the best. Well, since we're not playing Barry White, I want you to hear something that's relatively new, at least from a DJ's perspective. Here's Craig Runk with Ooh Baby, You're Driving Me Crazy. Let me tell you, that song right there was better than Barry White's entire discography. I'm not saying it's bad, I'm just saying that it doesn't take a full beige outfit to make, you know, love-making music. This is fine too, and yeah, Craig Runk, Ooh Baby, from 1982 and was released exclusively in Japan. This record right now is extremely hot because this song is becoming a hit, at least in China, as far as I know. It's kind of random, but it's not even on Spotify. I'm X, we're going to have the last song of tonight. Yes, it is that time again for yours truly to go. And in China right now, I'm actually going to have lunch. Anyway, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend and a great start of your next week. Hopefully you've enjoyed the past hour with me. I am DJ Lee and this is City Pop Central. The last song I'm going to play is dedicated to all those sweet summer days. It's called Summer Candles by the Japanese singer An Li.
Eat. You're listening to Public Affairs on WRCT Pittsburgh.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
So as the head of diverse segments, my responsibilities are to grow home ownership opportunities for underserved communities. And when we say underserved communities, we talk about low and moderate income communities and low and moderate income people. So those customers who make less than 80% of the median income for that area. I'm also accountable for growing diverse lending, ethnically diverse lending, across all income segments, because while we know there's a home ownership gap in our country, we equally have a gap in serving affluent minorities. So it's not just low income minorities, it's affluent minorities that also may have similar challenges to attaining a home.
Chuck Bishop, Senior Vice President, Head of Diverse Segments, Wells Fargo Home Lending. As a child growing up in Washington, D.C., he watched his mother live in the same apartment for 42 years and paid a total of $907,000 in rent. His path to home ownership is personal because he didn't live in a house until he became an adult and bought his own. At Wells Fargo, Bishop's job is to expand home ownership opportunities for the underserved communities, which include people of color and individuals with low to moderate incomes. Home ownership is a key pillar of the American dream. It's a pathway to financial success and a source of stability in our communities. Also, owning a home is one of the most important pathways to wealth creation, providing families with a foundation for improving their financial position across generations. I'm Johnny Ohanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Home Ownership with Chuck Bishop, Senior Vice President, Head of Diverse Segments, Wells Fargo Home Lending in Black America.
You know, we've got some historic challenges. You got to think about, there was years ago, prior to the Fair Housing Act, discrimination was legal. We also were at a point in our history where the federal government would not insure a community where there were Black and brown residents. So you think about after World War II, when a lot of veterans came back and obtained VA loans, well, it was a challenge for African-American soldiers to get those loan programs because they couldn't get those loans insured. So you think about, there are systemic issues that were policy created. And then even today, you have challenges with rising home prices, inequitable income. You think about homes in typically minority communities, you don't see a lot of homes for sale as much as you do in other communities, because we've got institutional investors who buy the homes, or you have commercial entities who buy those homes and turn them into long-term rentals.
As head of Wells Fargo's Home Lending Diverse Segments, Chuck Bishop has built a decade-long career helping people of color purchase homes. The rate among African-American home ownership sits at 44% and has only bumped up by 0.4% in the last decade. This is easily 29 percentage points less than white Americans at 72.7%. As Bishop sees it, home ownership is critical for a lot of reasons. For one, we know that home ownership is the beginning of the creation of wealth. Most Americans use their home ownership journey as a pathway to legacy opportunities that some family pass their property to their heirs. It is often the biggest purchase that many people make. Studies have shown that children who grow up in homes where their parents are homeowners often do better in school, have a higher graduation rate, and a lower truancy rate than children of parents who rent. Recently, In Black America spoke with Chuck Bishop.
Philadelphia, I was only there for a year, so I don't remember much about Philly. But in Washington, D.C., you know, I'm old enough to experience a lot of things, you know, post-civil rights activities. I remember the riots in Southeast Washington. I had the pleasure of opening one of the first bank branches east of the Anacostia River after the riots. I remember, you know, all of the activities behind elections. I remember, and I still see all the tourism here. So growing up in the D.C. area has a lot of advantages, and you get a lot of exposure to a lot of culture and history.
I understand. So what particularly sparked that interest for you to be involved in the financial service industry?
You know, I wish, John, I could tell you there was some grand plan that came together for me and worked out the way I started. But I went to college and was a business major, knew I wanted to work with money or in revenue some way, and I wanted to work with people. Came out and was hired by a bank right out of college, and thus kind of became my journey in financial services. Started in traditional retail banking, branch banking, and then changed into the mortgage business later on. But I got to tell you, John, this might be part of my heredity. My mother told me long ago that her parents met at a bank. So my maternal grandmother and grandfather met when they were 15, working at a bank in Lawrenceville, Virginia, where unfortunately they couldn't even go through the front door. They were domestics working at night as cleanup. And that's where they met and fell in love and got married. So you might say banking's kind of in my blood.
You were born into the industry.
Apparently so.
What college did you attend?
Virginia Tech.
Now, I understand that while you were growing up, your mom never owned a home. She lived in an apartment for 42 years?
My mother lived in an apartment much longer than that. My mother has rented for more than 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
I never lived in a home until I bought one.
Mm. Tell us about that growing up in an apartment and your mother never made the transition to home ownership. Did she just didn't want to own a home, or what was it?
You know, John, growing up and even early in my financial services career, I didn't ask the question. You know, my mother and father divorced when I was really young. And I would tell you by the time I was 10, I had lived in six different rental places. So we moved a lot early in my life. Later on, she became a bit more stable with her residence, and she moved because of either career growth and other opportunities. But when she settled down, her last apartment she lived in for 42 years, that one apartment, so that's the number you got, the 42 years. She has dementia now, and unfortunately I had to move her from that apartment 2 years ago into an assisted living facility. But it was then that I was going through years and years of kind of records when I realized that, you know, my mother has rented for more than 60 years. And when I started looking at how much she's paid, John, it's close to, at this point, close to $1 million that she's paid in rent. That's money that she's paid to use somebody else's property. That's money that she didn't create her own wealth with. She didn't get her own equity. She doesn't have debt as a reserve today. That's money that paid somebody else's mortgage all those years.
At Wells Fargo, what are your responsibilities currently?
So as the head of diverse segments, my responsibilities are to grow home ownership opportunities for underserved communities. And when we say underserved communities, we talk about low and moderate income communities and low and moderate income people. So those customers who make less than 80% of the median income for that area. I'm also accountable for growing diverse lending, ethnically diverse lending, across all income segments. Because while we know there's a home ownership gap in our country, we equally have a gap in serving affluent minorities. So it's not just the low-income minorities, it's affluent minorities that also may have similar challenges to attaining a home.
What are some of the hurdles that people of color have to overcome to become homeowners?
You know, John, one of the biggest hurdles that we've got to overcome is the myth that we believe. The myth that we believe around having to have perfect credit, having to have a 20% down payment, having to have, you know, X number of years at the job. Those things need to be, you know, fully understood. Today, education is what's really important for customers who decide whether they want to own or not. Not owning a home shouldn't be because you don't think you have access. There are so many programs today. There's so many resources available. You know, I highly encourage people to reach out to a HUD-approved nonprofit counseling agency to begin the conversation about where I am in my life journey, as far as financially being prepared, and then understanding where do I need to go and get to before I buy. Don't just go hire a realtor or go see a realtor right away because you saw a home on Zillow and you think you want to buy it. You need to really find your money before you start to find a home.
Are there any special programs that Wells Fargo offer that's similar to other lending institutions offer for people of color to become homeowners?
Absolutely. And 2023, we created a special purpose credit program specifically targeted to help purchase homes. So the special purpose credit program allows us to help homeowners who are buying in certain communities. We provide them with a down payment. One of the biggest challenges for people of color when it comes to buying a home is either the debt to income, meaning the monthly payment is too high, or two, the LTV is too high, meaning the amount they're borrowing versus the value of the property is too high. At Wells Fargo, we look to help eradicate some of those impediments to buying a home. So creating a down payment assistance grant where we are gifting to the recipient $10,000 helps to lower that payment. It not only lowers the payment, it lowers the LTV. So customers move into their home with equity and with a lower payment, thus getting rid of one of the challenges that's the biggest hurdle, and that's the affordability piece. As you know, interest rates are a little higher than people typically want to buy with, and home prices are steadily increasing. So we can't control the price of homes, but we can make a contribution towards the affordability piece, and that's where the Home Buyer Access product comes into play. We've also created another program called the Dream Plan Home Mortgage, which is a mortgage program that has a more competitive feature to it, allowing it to compete against government programs and other traditional mortgage programs, and it also has a closing cost companion with it that can provide $5,000 in closing costs for customers in selected markets.
How did people of color become so underserved in the home ownership arena?
Wow, that's a question that could take a lot of time to answer. We've got some historic challenges. You got to think about, there was years ago, prior to the Fair Housing Act, discrimination was legal. We also were at a point in our history where the federal government would not insure a community where there were black and brown residents. So you think about after World War II, when a lot of veterans came back and obtained VA loans, well, it was a challenge for African-American soldiers to get those loan programs because they couldn't get those loans insured. So you think about, there are systemic issues that were policy created, and then even today you have challenges with rising home prices, inequitable income. You think about homes in typically minority communities, you don't see a lot of homes for sale as much as you do in other communities because we've got institutional investors who buy the homes, or you have commercial entities who buy those homes and turn them into long-term rentals. So we don't have the same turnover of properties, which means there's less available to buy. It challenges the affordability that way. So there's no one place that creates this problem. There are so many different avenues that are creating headwinds. We've got work to do in the policy space. We've got work to do in the product space. And we've got work to do in the inventory space.
In my job, I get a chance to travel a lot, and I observed over time and over years that the homes built in majority communities are not the same type of homes built in people of color and brown community. Am I not seeing that correctly?
I don't know if I can validate that statement necessarily. I think you'll find builders that are going to build according to the income levels of the market that they can support. They're not going to build a home that's an $800,000 house in the community where there's $60,000 median income levels all around. They need to be able to move the property. So what I do think you'll find is you don't find enough inclusionary housing, meaning where they do build higher-end homes, they should build equally appealing homes of lesser price. So if you've got that $800,000, five-bedroom home, you can build a $400,000 home that looks very much like it, but smaller, and maybe not as sophisticated with the amenities, but a home that is equally, amenable to the purchaser, because there's got to be an entry point. And it can't be that we build all these communities that are on the fringe of affordability where people in the neighboring areas can't afford. There's got to be greater inclusionary housing, but it's also got to be more developers creating loans at the entry-level prices. That's the bigger challenge I see. Most of the new construction is at such a high level that people can't afford. And when the people who own homes, for instance, myself, I'm not going to sell my home anytime soon. So if I'm not moving because interest rates are high or higher, my house doesn't become available for the person behind me who may be able to afford this home, because I'm not going to move to the next one. There's a little bit of a cycle where you've got to have people moving out of those homes they bought 10, 15 years ago to buy the next one. That frees up that real estate because there isn't as much development in that space. And people aren't moving because rates are a little higher than they want to buy today.
Speaking of 10 or 15 years ago, 2008, there was that housing crisis. How did that affect people of color And how did that affect you doing what you do?
Wow, that was a wake-up call for the industry. I think for people of color, it's unfortunate because many people were taken advantage of by getting loans that were, they were called subprime loans. And they were exotic mortgages that had adjustments or potentially balloon payments that would make it, that made it unaffordable. Again, when we started this conversation, John, the first thing I said was get educated, understand the nuances of the mortgage and make sure you know what you're getting into. And then there were much, I say, less stringent credit policies in place. So there were people getting homes that, you know, had low incomes, but they got it at a lower payment with the assumption that their incomes are going to jump in 3 to 5 years to be able to cover the increase in payment. And the reality knows that doesn't happen. Incomes don't jump significantly in 3 to 5 years. So it's not a program that Wells was deeply involved in. We never were a subprime lender like that. But again, you'll see there are a lot of black and brown communities where those loans were used disproportionately higher than other communities. And when those loans don't repay, you'll see a disproportionate impact to those communities due to the foreclosures.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back in just a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Chuck Bishop, Senior Vice President, Head of Diverse Segment, Wells Fargo Home Lending. Mr. Bishop, how assuring when customers come in and see a gentleman like you if they're a person of color?
So are you asking me about me being black in my role? Does that make the customer more comfortable? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
A person of color will be more, they're already apprehensive from the get-go,
sure,
but seeing you and explaining the process, do it make them more comfortable?
Yeah. I think what's first and foremost, which should happen, is the person should look for competency. I think diversity is critical in all roles, at all levels of the bank. So whether it's, you know, at our executive levels or it's at our entry level, diversity is critical there, particularly as it relates to being able to understand language gaps and things like that. So that's a must. But with respect to executing a transaction, I would tell you that my bigger concern, more so than race, is acumen. I have to have somebody who is a professional in the business. And, you know, in my role, being black is an advantage because of my life experiences, because of the diverse values that I have and bring to the table in my experiences. But what's more important is I couldn't do this job unless I were a seasoned mortgage professional. You know, I spent time in the secondary market to understand the pooling of loans, understand how to measure risk, understand all those other things. So when it comes into selecting a mortgage professional, you really want somebody who's well vested in not just the industry, but understanding what opportunities are out there for you. Do they understand community loan programs that are available? Do they understand what the competitive landscape looks like? Do they understand where there's opportunities to lean into state and local government programs? So those are the things that are really important. It's often reassuring when you can relate to that person because they look like you, and we need to be representative of the community that we do business in. But I would tell you, it's equally as important to make sure that person is competent, because at the end of the day, it's your money.
When should one start thinking about purchasing a home and some of the steps they need to include to get to that point?
John, it's never too early. That question is really dependent upon where they are in their kind of financial journey. For some people, that might be 8 or 9 months. For some people, it could be 60, 90 days. If you're even thinking about buying, I highly encourage people to start to get educated. You can go to the Wells Fargo website, wellsfargo.com/mortgage-education, and you can use the tools there to understand how much can I qualify for, what programs are available, you know, what does my credit look like. You need to start to do some of the discovery work early, again, so you're not surprised. You can work with a nonprofit agency so they can run you through a hypothetical program to see where your challenges may or may not be. You can use one of the many credit scoring apps to kind of check your own credit and make sure there are no issues in your credit. Again, the last thing you should do is run to a real estate agent. I love my real estate agent professionals, but a real estate agent's not going to want to put you in their car unless they know you're qualified to buy this home. So that's why I say find your money first, do the work with a nonprofit agency. They are unbiased. They don't have any allegiance to a specific lender. They're going to counsel you on the best situation for you as an individual, and then they will give you options of many lenders to go and choose. Or you can start with a Wells Fargo loan officer who will sit and work with your situation. And if you're ready, proceed to help you with a pre-approval. If you're not ready, we can introduce you to one of those nonprofit counseling entities that can help you get ready. And I tell you, I don't ever like to tell a customer no. I might have to tell a customer not now, but I shouldn't ever tell you no.
As a 30-year veteran of this industry, what are some of the good things you've seen thus far?
Yeah, you had to say the 30-year part, huh, John? So you just put it out there.
Yeah, I had to put that there.
I've seen some amazing things in our industry. You know, I would tell you the creation of the Special Purpose Credit Program to actually acknowledge the historical challenges to underserved people, specifically people of color, and to say that, you know, there was no equity, so we need to provide an equitable opportunity for homeownership. That's huge. To see today banks cooperate. I actually work with, you know, what people think are my competitor entities, but they are actually peers. We can't overcome this racial inequity in housing as Wells Fargo alone. So I work on many industry task force. I work with governmental agencies to collectively come together and try to solution for this homeownership gap. Today, the difference between African-American homeownership and white homeownership is almost 30 percentage points. Wells Fargo can't do that by itself. We are a leader and have been a leader, one of the largest lenders to people of color for the last decade, but we need to have help in this battle. So the one thing I'm happy to see today is more collaboration across the financial services and across the government agencies, because we're all kind of rolling up our sleeves to a greater degree trying to eradicate this gap in homeownership.
Other than spending money, your money wisely, why is it important for one to own a home?
Well, I'll give you back to that example we started with. Let's talk about my mother. She spent almost $1 million in rent. I looked at the last unit she lived in, condo that she rented for somebody else. That condo would have sold for $65,000 the year she started renting it. The day she moved out, it was worth almost $300,000. So if you think about that, she would have paid for it clearly in that 42 years and had 12 years of savings. So she would have that $250,000 plus the 12 years of no mortgage payment. If you look at that right there, there's $300,000 that she doesn't have aside from the $1 million that she already paid. So the benefits of home ownership give you a piece of real estate that you can sell at a later date. That real estate is valuable for a lot of reasons. It finances your kids' college education. It provides equity to pay off other debts. In many cases, it's provided a jumpstart for small businesses who need some cash to run a small business. We also have tax benefits. So there's so many different things that happen financially because of home ownership, and then you have the social benefits. You know, it's been shown that children have less childhood disease. They do better in school. There's less teen pregnancy. There's less truancy. There's more local government involvement. The social benefits of homeownership are equally as beneficial as the financial benefits. So, you know, this homeownership piece, while it's what I do, I wouldn't push everybody into it because it's not for everybody. But those of you who listen to your show who think homeownership might be, I just will highly encourage them to just start the process by asking a question. Start to get the education, start to look at your personal situation. Doesn't cost you anything to do that. And what the lesson you learn is, maybe I am ready. I had a workshop in Dallas, Texas, where we had a Hispanic couple come in who didn't realize they were able to buy. Not only were they able to buy, they found out they were qualified for $15,000 in grant monies that day. Today, they moved in. It's two music teachers from the public school system with a three-month-old baby going to celebrate the holidays in their first home now. So, again, you don't know sometimes until you start the process, and don't let fear stop you. People think that today's interest rates, if they're 6%, 6.5%, oh, that's too high. My first house, John, I bought it was at 14%. That's what rates were at that point in time. It's never a bad time to be a first-time home buyer because you can always refinance.
Besides your involvement at Wells Fargo, I also understand that you served on the Freddie Mac Affordable Housing Council. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, you know, Freddie Mac is one of our partners in the fight for equitable housing. I've been on their advisory council. I've been on many boards for housing entities in the D.C. metropolitan area, and some having national responsibility. Being able to work with those partners allows me to help shape policy, to help influence direction of new mortgage programs, and it also helps connect the financial service entities with the rulemakers. And again, I started this conversation talking about we've got to have change in policy. We've got to continue to evolve the environment that governs mortgage processes. The mortgage business is highly regulated. And when we create programs will create outlets for mortgages. That's the secondary market. The more outlets we have for secondary execution, the more opportunities you'll have for primary mortgage products to be successful, thus creating a liquidity play. And I hope I didn't confuse a lot of people there, but the reality is you've got to have a cyclical cycle. When you make mortgages, you got to sell the mortgages to get that money to make more mortgages. That's where we have entities like Freddie Mac come into play. And having you see the table, it allows us to exchange information on understanding what we're seeing from consumer needs, what we're seeing from risk characteristics, and how we can continue to grow mortgage production through the creation of new programs.
Being an advisory to some of these programs, what would you like to see coming down the pike in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, man. I don't know if I'm prepared for that question, John. You know, I'd like to see a continuance of the investment in helping underserved customers. I'd like to see the focus on the development of affordable housing. I mean, our housing inventory is one of the biggest problems right now. We just don't have enough desirable affordable housing. There may be some affordable housing, but it may not be desirable. So ensuring that we have access to, you know, maybe creative restorative programs. Maybe we have programs that have streamlined refinance opportunities for customers who sit in a mortgage at a rate that's a little higher. Maybe we have innovative streamlined processes that can get customers through a process and get them refinanced quicker to get them at a lower rate. We think about home buying as kind of the big picture, and it is a big purchase. It's the biggest purchase most of us make. But the home buying process actually only lasts 60, 90, 120 days, whatever that time frame is for you to get prepared, buy your home, and settle. Home ownership lasts forever. So once you get in the house, you got to keep the house. So I like to see, you know, the continuance of post-purchase counseling. I like to see some innovation in the refinance space. And I like to see that we do more to put things like digital wills and education on heirs' properties in front of first-time home buyers, because the last thing you want to do is see a family lose a home that they might inherit because they don't know how to take care of it. They don't know that I inherited a home, but I still have to take care of the mortgage. They don't know that I inherited a home, but I may have to pay property taxes. So, you know, that's a whole other conversation we could have. We talk about buying a home, but the biggest challenge sometimes is keeping the home.
One question I want to ask before we run out of time. I've been seeing commercials on television talking about taking equity out of the home without having to refinance the mortgage. How does that work?
So you can get a home equity loan, which is a fixed term and a fixed rate, or some places have a HELOC, which is a home equity line of credit, which is basically a line of credit that's approved like a checkbook. You get $50,000, you can write the loan to yourself when you want to need it. What that really does is you're allowed to take the equity out of your home up to a certain percentage. I'm going to use easy numbers for the math. Let's assume your house is worth $100,000 and you want to get an equity loan and you owe $60,000 on your home. Often there'll be a LTV maximum. So the bank may say, well, you can get an 80% total loan to value.
Chuck Bishop, Senior Vice President, Head of Diverse Segments, Wells Fargo Home Lending. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
But we begin tonight with January 6th, today's date, which used to hold an unremarkable place on the political calendar. The ceremonial day when every 4 years, Congress certifies the foregoing presidential election. Certification Day remained unremarkable for 245 years, a mere formality that barely anyone noticed until 2021, when Donald Trump, having been tossed out of the presidency by 81 million voters following a failed first term that included a million COVID deaths and a recession, refused to accept being fired by the American people and instead, embarrassed by having lost to Joe Biden, lied to his enraged and disappointed supporters, telling them he hadn't lost at all, that the election had been stolen from him and from them by various phantoms, illegal immigrant voters, black and brown voters in swing state big cities, diabolical Democrats, the deep state, the voting machines themselves, and maybe even the ghost of Hugo Chavez. And with that big lie, Trump summoned his most ardent supporters to the Capitol.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong. And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
The president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me.
I couldn't believe my eyes. There were officers on the ground. You know, they were bleeding. They were growing up, they were, you know, they had, I saw friends with blood all over their faces. I was slipping in people's blood.
And from that day on, after more than 4 hours of hell, in which Trump sat in the White House watching on TV and throwing ketchup at the wall, as mobs of his supporters sacked the Capitol, injuring police officers, five of whom would wind up dead, alongside multiple Trump fans, one of whom got trampled by the mob and another shot by a police officer while trying to force her way into the speaker's lounge where terrified Congress members and young staffers were hiding. From that day on, this became the lasting memory and meaning of January 6th. This officer standing at the top of the stairs, tricking the mob into going left instead of right where the Congress members were hiding. This officer was trapped in a doorway, screaming for his life. These senators evacuating, fleeing for their lives, including this Missouri Republican, Josh Hawley, who you see circled, who just hours before fleeing in terror was throwing his fist up to the crowd like he was one of them. These Republican members cowering behind the House chamber door under the protection of a Capitol Police officer whose service they would later refuse to honor with votes in favor of congressional gold medals because they feared it would anger their Trumpy base. And these images, the so-called QAnon shaman and his fellow goons taking over the Senate chamber, a highly restricted area to the public, including this guy who brought zip ties. And this old man who ransacked then Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office and then took a seat in her chair with his dirty feet up on her desk. This still unarrested person who left pipe bombs outside the Democratic and Republican committee headquarters. And of course, the noose the insurrectionists brought with them to Washington to hang Vice President Mike Pence with, over his refusal to commit a federal crime by pretending that Trump's fake electors were real and the real electors were invalid.
Bring him out!
Bring out Pence!
Bring him out!
Bring out Pence!
Bring him out!
Bring out Pence!
Bring out Pence! Bring out Pence! Bring out Pence! Bring out Pence!
This is January 6th. From that day forward. And pretending that this is no longer what today means is, to put it bluntly, an insult to every cop that was injured that day, every terrified congressional staffer and member, every Capitol worker who had to clean up the feces the Trump mob smeared on the walls, and to every decent notion anyone ever had about this country. It's also a lie. It's a lie most Republicans and even some in the media want to tell you because it makes Republicans feel better. And apparently making Republicans feel better is really important. Since while their elected officials hid in terror with every single Democrat, the party itself very quickly changed their minds, led by Trump and their favorite billionaire news channel, Rupert Murdoch's Fox. They created a new big lie that January 6th was just a normal tourist occasion and really not that big of a deal. Well, you know what? Sorry, but it was a big deal. It was an insurrection, the first violent sacking of our Capitol since the War of 1812. Trump's second impeachment was literally for the incitement of an insurrection. And the idea of forgetting that, of just moving on and pretending there's no harm, no foul, and preparing to quietly reinstall the chief insurrectionist without comment, is frankly a shameful idea. The fact that so few voters found his actions disqualifying, the Supreme Court conservatives' negation of the Constitution's insurrection clause so our shameless Chief Justice John Roberts could clear the way for his reelection, all of it is, sorry, utterly shameful. Today is not a day to commemorate. Yes, we've got to do it because that's what some of y'all voted for or failed to vote and cleared the way for, but for God's sakes, let's at least have the decency and dignity to be a little embarrassed. Embarrassed for the most cynical of political parties, for their supposed dear leader, for his billionaire bosses who paid to reinstall him, and for anyone who dismissed January 6, 2021 as not a deal breaker for the man for whom the violence occurred to be president again. You do realize the rest of the world can see us, right? And 14 days from today, you will hear many soberly and reverently laud the peaceful transfer of power. Well, I hate to be the fly at the picnic table, but you can't peacefully transfer power to an insurrectionist simply because it took them an extra 4 years to finish the job. This was a violent transfer of power, the most violent in U.S. history, if we're being honest. Joining me now is Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi, former chair of the January 6th Select Committee and ranking member of the Committee on Homeland Security. Congressman, it is wonderful to see you. And I want to give you an opportunity. You have just heard what I think about today, and I would like for you to tell us how you feel on today.
Well, obviously, what you saw today is how the process is supposed to work. The certification is a formality that's required. The vice president is supposed